We tend to think of microbes in terms of the diseases they can cause, like the flu and measles, but as science writer Ed Yong points out in his latest book called I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life, microbes are vital to our survival. For instance, without them, we couldn't eat or breathe. His book is published by Echo, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ed Yong to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
In the simplest of terms, what are microbes? Are bacteria and viruses microbes?
That's right. So we're talking about organisms that are too small to see with the naked eye. There's some debate about whether we should include viruses, but certainly bacteria, another group of small things called archaea, small fungi, protists, the whole world of tiny creatures that we can't see.
And aren't they the oldest form of life on Earth?
That's right. So if in the book I say that if we condense the entire history of the planet into a single calendar year, then humans probably only came up in the last half hour or so, whereas microbes have been around since the start of March. And all the life that we're familiar with, the stuff we can see, animals, plants and so on, they've been with us since no earlier than October.
So they must be quite hardy. Is it fair to say that we couldn't survive without microbes, but without us, they'd probably do just fine?
That's right. It's a microbial world, and we're just living in it. They would be entirely comfortable without us, but we depend on them for so very much.
How many varieties have been discovered?
My God, it's hard to say because new species and strains are being found all the time. And it's clear that we have barely begun to explore the microbial world. Entire new branches of the microbial family tree are constantly being discovered.
How long has microbiology been a field of study?
Well, it started really in about 1675. So there was a Dutch man called Antony van Leeuwenhoek, and he was the first human to see microbes with his eyes.
Because he had a telescope.
Well, yeah.
A microscope.
A microscope, right. Microscope. He created the best microscopes of the day. He fashioned these tiny, perfect lenses, sandwiched them between brass plates, and he created this little object that he could hold up. He had to hold it up to his eye, squint through it, but it could magnify things 10 times better than anything else around.
You mentioned that microbes are now on the front line of scientific research after years of being pushed to the sidelines. Mm. Why did it take so long for scientists to realize how important they are?
Well, first they were neglected and ignored for a very long time. And then people realized that different microbes could cause some of the most infamous diseases, so plague and tuberculosis and typhoid. So they became very quickly cast as germs, as things that we needed to kill and destroy lest they kill us.
And was that what the thinking at the time of Darwin?
Right, and that idea emerged at the time when the beginnings of the idea of natural selection was casting the entire natural world in terms of conflict and competition. So the idea that microbes could be beneficial, that they could be normal symbiotic parts of our body, not only went against germ theory, but against this prevailing idea of nature red in tooth and claw.
When was germ theory proposed?
So this would have been like few centuries after the initial discovery of van Leeuwenhoek, and it's a fantastic idea, right? It was correct, but it is it's shaped the cultural view of microbes since then. So to this day, people have print news articles saying that we swabbed a desk, loads of microbes, it's really dirty, that sort of thing.
Because we tend to think of microbes in terms of pathogens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we think of them as agents of disease. If we find them on surfaces or our belongings, we think that it means that they're dirty. But in fact, both of these things are very wrong. The vast majority of microbes are benign or beneficial, and they are everywhere. If you found a surface without microbes on it, that would be a bad sign.
My guest is Ed Yong, Y-O-N-G. His book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. It is published by Echo. So what do you mean by I Contain Multitudes?
So every human and indeed every animal, so every elephant and ant, contains a teeming collection of microbes in their body. The average human's contains about 37 trillion of them, which is around the same number as they have as the actual cells, our human cells. So at least half the cells in our body are microbial.
You compare microbiomes to archipelagos, where each person is a chain of islands. Mm-hmm. Why should we think about microbes that way?
Because if we zoom down, we are these entire worlds. We have so many living organisms within us, and the different parts of our body are like different habitats. So the forearm is like a desert. It is parched and barren. The nose and the mouth are like rainforests. They are humid and hot. And each of these places houses its own menagerie of species of microbial fauna.
What factors shape a person's microbiome?
That's a critical question, and we're still trying to answer it. My microbiome is very different to yours, which is different to any of our listeners right now. But scientists can only explain a small proportion of that variation. So we're still largely in the dark about what makes our microbiomes different.
And babies are born with microbiomes?
They are. So the womb is a sterile environment, but when babies are born, they are covered in mum's vaginal microbes. And then breast milk is this astonishing way of feeding microbes in a baby's gut. About 10% of milk contains these sugars that babies can't digest, but that nourish its first microbes.
How long does it take for babies to evolve into a mature state, microbially speaking?
It takes about 3 years to reach an adult state. And what's interesting about that is that the bacteria change in very predictable waves, just as like a new island would be colonized by like lichens, then shrubs, then trees. You get these very stable, very obvious patterns of ecological succession.
If someone has a food allergy, does that mean that they don't have the right microbes?
There have been links between allergies and the microbiome, certainly, because it seems that exposure to microbes at an early age helps to calibrate the immune system, getting this nice balance between reacting to potential infections but not overreacting to harmless things like stuff in our food or allergens. So maybe an imbalance of those two sides, maybe a lack of exposure to the right microbes at an early stage leads to that.
The older you get, the more microbes you have been exposed to, and the more diverse your microbiome gets. Does that mean that people can outgrow allergies but perhaps develop other problems?
I think it's more likely. Well, actually, once we get to adulthood, a lot of our microbiome is very stable. So there's a lot of dynamism. It changes with our meals, times of the day. But overall, there's this underlying stability. And I think one of the grand goals of microbiome research is trying to figure out ways of actually manipulating these communities.
But you say that microbiomes depend to some degree on the people we're with, mm-hmm. whether we have pets. I'm assuming the person I sat next to on the subway gave me a couple
right.
of microbes today.
Yeah, that's right. There's this constant traffic of microbes in and out of our bodies that connects us to the world around us. Like we are expelling microbes into the air space around us. We take it in when we touch our fellow people. And pets, like you say, dogs supercharge that flow because they bring in so many environmental microbes into our lives.
Do some diseases occur because of the changes in our microbiomes?
That is the critical question in this field of research and the one that scientists are still trying to answer. So the microbiome has been linked to so many different conditions, obesity, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease. But it's still being worked out whether those changes in the microbiome cause the conditions or are a consequence of them.
Can a good microbe shift into a pathogenic state?
Yeah. Sometimes if a microbe in the gut that helps us digest our food, if it gets across the lining of the gut and enters the bloodstream, it can trigger inflammation. And likewise, entire communities of microbes can shift from a beneficial state into a harmful one. So it's important to realize that there isn't really a such thing as a good microbe or a bad one. They are just part of us, and their relationships with us can change.
Do we understand what triggers that change?
There are many possible contributors. So we know that our diet strongly affects our microbiome. Whether we take antibiotics or medications can have an impact. How much microbes we're exposed to in the world around us.
I would assume that would also apply to somebody who's a vegetarian who then eats meat.
Yeah. So
when we eat meat, are we getting microbes or have they been killed off by the heat?
It depends on whether they've been cooked or not. One of my favorite microbe stories is that Japanese people used to harvest seaweed and they would eat it raw. And marine microbes on the seaweed made their way into the gut and they gave gut bacteria genes that allowed them to digest the unique carbohydrates in seaweed, which is why to this day, Japanese gut microbiomes are better at breaking down the stuff in sushi than those from other countries.
You mentioned that the microbe can be invaluable in one organ and then lethal in another. How do we stop them from traveling to places that they shouldn't be going to?
So we have many ways of control of containing our multitudes. We have barriers. So we have the wall of the gut. We have a layer of mucus over that. We have the immune system patrolling the gut, sending molecules that work out, that decide who gets to stay where. And we feed them with specific things like the breast milk sugars that I told you about.
So we live in a kind of symbiotic state.
That's right. We have an alliance with them. And like all good relationships, it takes work and it can possibly break. But, you know, by and large, we have this stable, good relationship.
Who's in charge?
That's a really good question.
If it's symbiotic, yeah, then right. It's almost equal, isn't it?
You could argue that that we are in charge because we are the host. We like to think the big thing is running the show. But microbes affect so many things. They affect our immunity. They might even affect our thoughts and our behavior. So I feel that our bodies and our lives are built in conversation, in negotiation with the things that live with us.
Do some microbes decide to settle with a particular host?
Yes.
Yeah, do we attract them?
So if you look in the animal kingdom, there are some amazing examples of very specific partnerships. There is this squid that manages to pull one particular bacterium out of the thousands in the water and hosts only it. And it glows. It creates these light shows from the squid's underside that perfectly match the moonlight welling down from above. So the bacteria cancel out the squid's shadow to any predators looking from above and make it invisible.
You mentioned that microbes have their own genes. Mm-hmm. How does that help the host?
Well, if an animal is trying to adapt to a new environmental challenge, it can accrue gradual mutations in its genome in a classically Darwinian way. But it can also partner with microbes that have the right adaptations already, that have the genes necessary for that challenge. And by doing that, animal evolution can be very, very fast. So there are insects, for example, that can become instantly resistant to insecticides if they swallow the right microbes with the right detoxification genes.
Are they part of our genome?
To an extent, yes. It seems that that some bacterial genes have made their way into animal genomes. They seem to enter some human cells, but don't become a continual part of our germline. But there are many cases where animals seem to have acquired these incredible abilities by picking up bacterial genes. There are parasites that attack plants. There's a beetle that destroys coffee beans that can only do so because it has bacterial genes in its own genome.
A listener, Becca from Brooklyn, called in to say she was just diagnosed with H. pylori and was prescribed antibiotics, but she's worried that it'll wipe out the necessary microbes as well.
So H. pylori is a really interesting case because it can cause stomach ulcers and stomach cancer, but it has also been linked to esophageal cancer. It's been linked to a reduced risk of esophageal cancer. So it has benefits and risks, and it's been with us for a long time. It's been with the human species for tens of thousands of years. The thing about antibiotics is that they are unsubtle weapons. They've done a huge amount of good, but they also have collateral damage.
And in women, it can lead to yeast infections.
So if you take chronic doses of antibiotics, it can clear out the native microbes in your body and create opportunities for these weedy invasive species to take hold. But there have been many studies looking at this, and in most cases, antibiotics, you know, they dent the microbiome, but the microbiome bounces back. So like any good ecosystem, it has resilience. So it's not to say that antibiotics are, you know, you shouldn't fear them.
My guest is Ed Yong, an award-winning science writer on the staff of The Atlantic. He has a blog called Not Exactly Rocket Science, which is hosted by National Geographic magazine. And he has written for The New Yorker, Wired, The New York Times, Nature, New Scientist, Scientific American, The Guardian, The London Times, Discover, Slate, and other publications. His book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life, is published by ECCO, ECCO. We will continue our conversation after this. And we're back with Ed Yong. His book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life, it's published by ECCO. You write that some animals rely on bacterial cues to mature and reproduce. What are the alternatives to relying on bacterial cues to do that?
Well, there really isn't any alternative. Animals evolved in a bacterial world. We had to learn to live with them and to exploit them. So there are, one of my favorite examples, there are these marine worms called H. elegans, and they create these little white tubes that can become so numerous that they clog the propellers of ships. And they can only make the tubes if they become adults, and they can only become adults if they encounter the right bacteria in the environment. If all the microbes in the ocean disappeared, these worms would be forever stuck as kids, like Peter Pan.
You mentioned that microbes help to shape our immune systems. Is this as beneficial to the microbe as it is to the host?
It's a symbiosis. So from a microbe's perspective, you don't want the immune system to be just going berserk to everything. So there are species that have these anti-inflammatory properties that quench the immune reactions in our bodies. But that's good for us too, because it does stop us from like going nuts into nuts and pollen and other things.
When people get nervous, their stomachs sometimes start to churn. Does psychological behavior affect gut microbes?
Yeah, there is this really interesting thing called the gut-brain axis, so like a two-way communication chain between the brain and the gut. So the way we think...
Some people have said that there's a brain in the gut.
Right, yeah, exactly. So the way we think and we feel affects the microbiome and vice versa. You know, that microbes release neurotransmitters, things that we think of as brain signaling chemicals. There is a nerve that runs from the gut to the brain and carries signals.
So if bacteria can affect human brain activity, can it also help stabilize mental health?
That's one thing that a lot of people are looking at the moment. So whether if you give like the beneficial bacterium, you could help to reduce some of the symptoms of depression or anxiety. It's a very active area of research.
That might suggest that microbes are making some of our decisions for us or manipulating us.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
Who's in charge?
There are loads of examples in nature of brain-controlling parasites. But that's obviously a kind of a negative example. I feel that it's very clear that microbes can influence animal behavior, but the extent to which that happens is what we don't really know at the moment.
Can a microbe benefit one host or part of the host while causing harm to another one?
Yeah, so the best example of this, there is a type of worm, a nematode, that kills insects by vomiting out these toxic bacteria into its body. And so the bacteria is obviously helpful to the worm, deadly to the insect. And incidentally, those same worms and those bacteria, they glow. And soldiers in the Civil War often had these glowing wounds that they called the angel's glow, because the toxins from the microbes would prevent infections from taking hold.
We've used the word symbiosis, which implies an important mutually beneficial relationship. If some microbes have the potential to cause us harm, is it wrong to call some microbe-host relationships symbiotic?
So symbiosis in its original meaning actually just means living together. I think it's taken on this air of positivity.
You help me.
Right, yeah. But actually, in many cases, we don't know whether those relationships are mutually beneficial or not, which is why I say that there is no such thing as a good or a bad microbe. These relationships can turn on a dime.
You write that microbes in humans and other vertebrates live around our cells, not inside them. What are the implications for that?
So our guts, for example, host massive communities of microbes that help to digest our food.
And what do the microbes get out of that?
Well, they get food. So they get to eat, and eat in eating, they help us eat. And we get a small amount of our energy through microbial digestion, but something like a cow or a deer gets, you know, up to 70%. Like, these are animals that wouldn't be able to survive if they didn't have these giant fermenting guts and that house trillions of microbes that are breaking down the otherwise indigestible things in their food.
Should I assume that microbes are behind the formation of milk in animals?
Well,
am I drinking a cow's microbiome when I'm drinking milk?
There are some microbes in milk, but I think the most astonishing thing about milk is the story I said about how sugars in it help to nourish our gut microbes. You know, they are a way of, breast milk is a way of feeding not just an infant, but setting up an entire world inside the infant's gut.
What happens to a baby's immune system when the microbes from vaccinations enter its bloodstream? Is that harmful?
It is not.
Are babies more vulnerable to infection as a result?
No, not at all. Vaccinations are an unrivaled health good. They have saved so many lives, and they are a wondrous thing.
Is there a way to feed your baby the right microbes so that they don't need a lot of shots?
Well, no. I mean, if you want to get, I think I am a big proponent of vaccination. I think it's a great idea. Whether we can influence a baby's microbiome in other ways is something that's being investigated. But as I said, like, breastfeeding is a great way of setting up those microbes, not by giving them, but by feeding the right species.
Something that I found bizarre was the black reefs. Can you explain what they are?
Yeah, so coral reefs can be killed by lots of different things, but shipwrecks and other things that are rich in iron can just wipe them out. You can, you know, you can drop like everything from like an iron bolt to an entire ship on a reef, and the coral around will blacken. And that's because the extra iron nourishes, changes the community of microbes that live on the corals, shifting them from this healthy state to one that is more likely to cause disease.
I'd always assumed that the problem with coral reefs was climate change.
Very much so. And these things are all connected. So a lot of the problems with coral reefs are overfishing, nutrient pollution. These change the rivalries between corals and competitors called turf algae. And the algae then change the microbe communities on the coral reef. So this is just one way in which corals can die, thanks to all these other stresses in their environment.
Since microbes are in our gut, do they determine how susceptible we are to gaining weight?
There is a lot of evidence linking microbiome and obesity. So we know that obese individuals have different microbes in their gut than lean ones. But what that means is still unclear. There have definitely been experiments where you can take the microbes from an obese mouse and put them in the body of a sterile rodent, and that rodent will then gain a lot of weight. So that implies that the microbes are, to some extent, like grabbing the real wheel rather than just going along for the ride. But what extent that matters for us in the real world is still unclear.
Do they also cause weight loss?
There have been some, well, unhealthy weight loss, sure. There have been some links between
I was thinking if you could give some weight loss microbes to people who are obese.
So I think it's not going to be that simple, because there have been studies done with rodents looking at that. Like, everyone wants like the magic pill, right, that is going to help them lose weight without effort. In one very important experiment, those microbial transplants only worked if the mice were eating healthy diets anyway.
My guest is Ed Yong. His book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. Industrialized nations insist that hygiene is the best way to fight off diseases, and there are antibacterial mm-hmm. soaps and the like. Isn't there still a lot of truth to that? Because people who live in places where there is less hygiene mm-hmm. are much more likely to die younger.
Yeah, I think sanitation has again been a great public good. It has stopped the rise of a lot of infectious diseases. It is important in things like settings like hospitals. But I think we take it too far. I think we, because of our fear of bacteria, we have antibacterial everything now. And that is disconnecting us from the microbial world that we depend upon.
Why do more developed countries have higher rates of inflammatory diseases?
Possibly for that reason, because microbes help to build and calibrate our immune systems. So if we lack an exposure to a diverse range of microbes from an early age, we might be left with twitchy, overreactive immune systems that are more likely to go berserk when they spot harmless things around us.
So should I be eating dirt?
You know, one of my friends, a microbiologist, actually bought a dog because he's got young kids, and dogs, you know, bring a lot of stuff into houses. They act as conduits between the outdoor microbial world and the indoor one.
And you mentioned that the more people and pets you have around you, the more diverse your microbiome will be. What if you live in a densely populated city like New York as opposed to a farm with lots of animals?
Yeah, there was actually a really interesting study recently looking at two communities, the Amish and the Hutterites. So the Amish have very, very low rates of things like asthma. And one possible reason is that their kids play in these barns, they get exposed to like animal-associated dust, and they get those early microbial exposures that might help to properly calibrate their immune systems and reduce the risk of allergic and inflammatory diseases.
A listener, Holly from Milburn, asks, can you please comment on how effective probiotic products in health food stores are?
Unfortunately, they are a little underwhelming. So there has been a lot of research on probiotics. It's a very huge industry. And they seem to be good for some kinds of infectious diarrhea, which is nothing to sniff at. But there's so many health claims around probiotics. And a lot of like regulatory agencies have taken a dim view about those claims because a lot of them aren't backed up by really solid evidence.
But if you eat yogurt, for example, aren't you putting good microbes into your body?
You're putting a very small number of microbes that have been chosen for historical reasons because they're easy to manufacture rather than because they are especially good at living in the gut or influencing our biology. So, it's like releasing a small number of domesticated animals into the wild and hoping that they'll survive. So they don't establish themselves. They don't take up, they don't make themselves at home in our bodies when we eat them. They could blow in and out.
Diabetes, heart disease, colon cancer, other leading causes of death in the developed world are rare in other parts of the world. Is that because of the different kinds of microbial colonies that are on people?
I mean, it might be a contributor. There are certainly important links between microbes and diseases like colorectal cancer, heart disease. But I think like everyone wants the one explanation for all of our health problems because that suggests that there is an easy way of fixing it. But I think there are so many things that contribute to the risk of these very complex disorders. And we know that the microbial component may be one of them, but it is just one part.
What are holobionts and hologenomes?
It's just a nice way of thinking of these communities, of the fact that animals and their animals depend on the microbes. So we think of like the Ed Yong holobiont as me and all the microbes that I contain, or the hologenome as my genes plus the genes of all the microbes that live within me. It's a concept that emphasizes the holistic nature of our lives.
What is HGT?
HGT is horizontal gene transfer. So that's the thing I mentioned earlier, where microbes, if they come next to each other, can swap their DNA as easily as you or I might like swap conversation now or GIFs later. It's a startling ability which allows microbes to evolve at a breakneck pace.
I've heard that it's not a good idea for a pregnant woman to have a cat because of microbiome transfer. No,
I don't think there's any. I don't think there's any good evidence behind it. Oh, actually, no. You're talking about toxoplasmosis.
Yes.
So there's a cat parasite called Toxoplasma gondii, which can cause severe problems if it infects women during pregnancy.
You say that some bacteria are going extinct. Which kinds of bacteria? Are we talking about good ones? Or?
Well, our caller earlier mentioned Helicobacter pylori. That's actually one of them. Because we've mounted such a successful campaign at destroying it, it is becoming much, much less common now. It used to be everywhere, and now it's becoming a rarity, at least in the Western world. It's very much a part of us elsewhere.
Are there ways to preserve the microbes that we want?
That is something that we're trying to work out right now. Are these losses important? So we might be missing some of these old friends that have been with us for a long time. And I think there's concerns that they are doing important things.
Ed Young will be in conversation with Maria Konnikova this Saturday, August 13th at 4 p.m. at Idea Distillery. That's at 195 East 3rd Street. For tickets and information, visit wmyc.org/lopate. His book, I Contain Multitudes, is published by Echo. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.